Before we get started, I want to tell you why I keep urging you to use KISS Insights. Haven't you noticed that one of the big ideas that keeps coming up in my interviews is the need to ask your customers and users what they want instead of imagining that you know? Now, when you add a survey to your website, isn't it true that hardly anyone fills out your survey, and people who do fill it out aren't necessarily your typical users? Well, what KISS Insights does is give you surveys that are so easy to fill out that your users will actually complete them. Here's a screenshot of how I use KISS Insights. You can use it for free right now. Just go to kissinsights.com. Next thing I want to show you is the phone number at the top of dnamail.com. When you have trouble with your email and it's costing your business both money and reputation, how frustrating is it? Well, who can you call at those moments? If you use DNA Mail, you'll have a phone number you can call 24/7. DNA Mail offers complete hosted exchange, free setup, free activation, free support, and if you and your company need Google Apps, they've got you covered there too. DNAMail.com. These aren't just sponsorships, these are tools you should use. Finally, I want you to know about Shopify.com. If you already have an online store and want to increase your sales, go to Shopify.com. If you have an idea for an online store, go to Shopify.com. With Shopify, they'll set up your store in minutes. You'll get professional themes to customize your store. You'll even get a mobile app to manage your store from anywhere. Check out Shopify.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. Today's entrepreneur launched a business and then got it funded. And then, while he was going through this seed incubation process, sold that business and switched to another company. That's what fascinated me about you, Russ D'Souza. That's why I invited you here to Mixergy, to find out how you do this, why you sold it, how you decided on a whole new company, and how you were able to launch that new company inside of what I think Dream It is the company that funded you. I think they have just 3 months of incubation. Right?
It's a little over 3 months, yeah.
About three and a half months. You sold a company, relaunched a company, and then got it so good that you were able to take it to TechCrunch 50 and become one of the finalists of TechCrunch 50. So first of all, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
I'm really glad to meet you. Second, let's find out what this business was. What was it called?
So the business that we had prior to SeatGeek was a company called Scribnia. S-C-R-I-B-N-I-A, and it's still, you know, it's up and running. They have hundreds of thousands of users every single month. They're doing very, very well. And so we applied to Dream Adventures, and for those of you guys who don't know, Dream Adventures is similar to Y Combinator and Techstars, some of these other incubators that are out there, and it's located in Philadelphia. So we ended up accepting a position at Dream It for their summer class of 2009. We applied with the idea of Scribnia. At the time, we were in sort of this private alpha, private beta stage. Obviously had no traction because of that. But we applied with the idea and a proof of concept, and the folks at Dream It liked what they saw, but wanted to obviously challenge us on how we're going to grow this. How is it going to be a huge site? And we had good answers to that, and I think they also liked the two of us. You know, we had founded a business prior to that before, and our backgrounds were sort of unique. We were management consultants turned web entrepreneurs, so had the business experience side of things, but also taught ourselves to program and were technically adept as well.
All right, let's take this very slowly. Let's find out where this – I want to make sure that I dig into every part of this.
Sure.
Where did the idea come from for this idea, this Yelp of internet writers, which is what Scribnia was?
So there are thousands upon thousands of internet authors out there. It's so difficult to know who you can trust. It's so difficult to find out any information about them. And it's also, for example, I love reading Bill Simmons. I'm sure you know who Bill Simmons is, popular author for ESPN. Every single time one of his posts comes out, I'm eager to read them. And I'm always wondering, if I like Bill Simmons this much, there must be other authors who I would enjoy reading as well. And it's not ESPN authors necessarily, because there are a number of ESPN authors that I just can't stand reading. But I'm sure there are other authors who are like them. So if we can build the system that lets users rate and review every author out there, not on just a scale of 1 to 10, but also on factors relevant to them. So for a political author, are they liberal, conservative bias, or show their bias, etc. should we build the recommendation algorithm that would give people a good sense of who they would like to read?
Okay, all right, and I would love that even today, and nobody's solved that yet. I can find articles that people who I like and respect are interested in, but I can't find writers like that.
Yep. And our thought is once you find the writers that you like, then you'll always be able to find good articles that you like to read.
Okay, so you had this idea. What did you guys do? How did you launch it?
So the first thing we did, and you know, we learned a lot along the way. So the first thing we did was we said, this is an idea that affects the two of us. You know, we personally have always wanted to find more authors, and we knew that at least there was two people in the universe, and we talked to our friends, obviously, who have the same problem. In hindsight, I wish we talked to more people, because the more input that you get at that early stage, the more you think about how you can build it and think about which problem you want to solve differently. But the first thing we actually did was we started building out the product. The two of us had very limited programming experience before this. We essentially taught ourselves how to program with the sole intention of building out the site. I focused more on the back end side of the code, and then my business partner Jack did a lot of the front end, and we were able to move pretty quickly. But you know, there's obviously a little bit of a hump as it takes, you know, time for you to familiarize yourself with how to code. And so we started programming in September 2008, and then had like a private, really, really private alpha launch in February 2009. And then about that time, we started applying to the incubators at, like Dream Adventures and Y Combinator.
What was in that alpha launch? What could the site do?
It was pretty functional. I mean, the big feature that it had was the ability to – so you could rate and review all these authors on these different – you know, 1 to 10 and also on these different contexts. When we launched in the alpha stage, we had this very cool way of filtering authors where, you know, you could – drag the handles around where you're like, I'm looking for a conservative author who's just, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 is a 5 in conservatism. And then I want someone who hides their bias. I'm going to look for, you know, someone who on a scale of 1 to 10 also is maybe a 10 hiding their bias.
That would allow people to figure out how much of a bias they were hiding?
Well, you know, you'd rate them on a scale of 1 to 10, and then you just had sliders that let you discover the authors that you like. Much like, say, you know, you go to Kayak and you want to slide around figuring out, okay, I want my plane to leave here. And you, same sort of idea. It's more qualitative, but because we're taking quantitative rankings in, you know, there was a process of being able to discover the authors just using these, like, very crisp, clean JavaScript sliding sliders that we built. And the other thing that we had at the time was we had the recommendation algorithm built, where we took in all the different context ratings and all the different ratings that the individual users put in, and then could spit out pretty accurately authors that they would like. And at the time, we didn't have that many users who were using the service, but we, from every single person we talked to, it seemed like we were giving good recommendations to people who were discovering new authors that they would like.
Okay. And did you seed the site with all the authors, or did you allow your audience to add authors?
So both. So we seeded, you know, we definitely seeded it with authors, but the big part of it was around user-generated content. We wanted people to input their favorite authors and you know, put the authors on the site that they like to read, and that brought, you know, they're adding value to the community and also, you know, figuring out authors that they would like as a result.
Okay, so that's the first launch, and that's what the launch was. And I know that there wasn't that much time to iterate because you sold it soon after you launched it, but how did the product evolve after that?
So, you know, we launched in – we had like our full all-out launch in May and sold it shortly thereafter. So we did iterate to some extent. We didn't go through the full iterating cycle that we do now at SeatGeek. I think we're just so much more agile now. And we learned the biggest thing is this is the first real web business that we ever built. And we learned just so much in terms of how quick you have to be, how nimble you have to be, how you have to test things, and how you test assumptions even before you start building products. So we sort of built these features that we thought made a lot of sense. And luckily, they seem to be a hit. You know, hundreds of thousands of people use that site now. But in hindsight, I wish we'd done more thinking about how we can build these really, really quickly and get them in front of people, get feedback, and incorporate that feedback and make a better site.
Okay, so then you apply to Dream It. Why did you apply to Dream It?
So we applied to a number of the other to several other incubators.
Which ones?
You know, the usuals, Techstars, Y Combinator. We really, really liked the people at Dream It. I think that the one thing that Dream It had and they really pushed was this concept that you guys were going to be all the teams were all together within one room working over the summer. I know that's something that differentiates itself from Y Combinator. They talked a lot about the speakers that they would bring in, and you know, once to even twice a week, they would bring in these top-notch speakers. Guys like Josh Koppelman would come in and give their time for an hour. Brad Feld, really top-notch people in the Philadelphia community, even outside the Philadelphia community, who would talk about a certain aspect of entrepreneurship and give advice, practical advice, hands-on advice on how that can be applied. And so we had a great experience there. And that was the things that they touted when we applied, and they definitely lived up to their expectations.
Was your application accepted by Techstars and Y Combinator?
So the way the process works is that, once you apply, the different incubators get back to you pretty quickly. And when they do get back to you, they expect an answer shortly thereafter. So we actually, Dream It Ventures actually very high on our list and was the first company that actually accepted us. And we felt very good about it. So we had late interviews with, all the other incubators, but we ended up choosing to do Dream It Ventures.
What do you mean by late interviews with the other?
They have an interview process where you like fly out to California, interview with Y Combinator. So that's what I was referring to. So we had for some of the incubators, we had an opportunity to go out and interview with them. But that interview would have taken place well after we had to let Dream Adventures know. So we were very happy with Dream Adventures and decided to do that.
I see. Okay. And I think now what's happened is that they've all lined up their application processes so that you're not put in that position, right?
To be honest, I know that was a problem last year. There's a post on TechCrunch actually about that particular issue. I think they've done a better job now of making sure that the entrepreneurs get more choice. But to be honest, these programs are so great that you learn so much at any one of them. So I think that there's this level of competitiveness among the different programs that I understand why that exists. But I think at the same time, as an entrepreneur, that it's so great that these companies do exist now. And I think, young people like us are lucky to be able to take advantage of them.
So why did you decide to go that route instead of calling up angel investors or friends and family and raising money from them?
Yeah, so I think Dream Ventures was the single best thing that I've done as an entrepreneur. I think it changed the way that I thought about businesses, and when you read through how these programs market themselves, that's what they really talk about, that this is a way for you to really change the way you think, to really have the luxury of building something over the summer. And to be honest, like if we had, I wouldn't know the first thing about before Dream It about how to raise money, and what the best way to do that is, and I'd be calling friends and family, calling angel investors, it wouldn't have been a very good process. I think Dream Adventures taught us the right way to do that, and it exposes you to a network of people who are looking to invest and are looking to invest in smart ideas. So we didn't have the network before that would, it's not a very, as you know, it's not easy to raise money. So having a huge network is a good network is important, and also knowing how to do it was important, and I learned both of those at Dream It.
Okay, so you get into Dream It. Actually, why? Why did they accept you? They apparently didn't like your idea. They helped you switch towards what became SeatGeek. Why? Yeah. What did they like about you?
I wouldn't say they didn't like our idea. I think that they understood that if you're building a Yelp.com, that model, you just need a ton of scale, tons of users in order for it to be a real revenue opportunity. And when you're in an alpha stage, you don't have any traction to show that this is going to be a company that's going to generate a lot of users and get that kind of traction. So I think that they smartly asked the right questions. Why is this the idea? Is this the team that's going to do it? But I do think that we made a good impression with them. I think that we understood those questions and answered them pretty well. And moreover, just as I said, having that unique background of having the business sort of, the business experience, but at the same time, it's few people have, not that many companies who had the business sense also were as technical as we were. So having that 2-point combination, they knew that we could move quickly and do different things, even if this idea didn't work out.
Do you think they had a sense that this idea wouldn't work out?
It's hard to say. I don't think so. I think that if they may have thought that we would pivot in some direction along the same idea. I don't think that they ever anticipated we'd be getting into ticketing. So if they expected anything, it would be for us to change our focus along Scribnia. But I don't think they anticipated us switching ideas completely.
Okay, where did the idea of switching occur? At what point?
Throughout the summer, almost as soon as we got to Dreamit, we started building out processes and started grabbing these listing transactional data. I mean, going back to what the genesis behind SeatGeek, both Jack and I are from Boston, and we would go to the secondary ticket markets all the time because you couldn't get tickets in Boston without doing so. Everything gets sold out all the time. This sports fanatic city. And we'd always feel like we were being ripped off. At the same time, saw a site like Kayak and Faircast out there that had a great model around aggregation, particularly with Faircast, had the analytic piece as well. And so we had thought about this idea for a while and it had germinated for a while. And we thought, look, let's just put ourselves in a position where we can, we can build this idea. In case Scrivenia doesn't work out the way that we hope it will. And so even before formally launching the site, we were already gathering all the data for us to do the predictive algorithm and putting ourselves in a position where we could build out the site really quickly.
Now, when you've got a business and you've already launched it and you're thinking about how to grow it, isn't your obsession on growing the one business instead of still thinking about all the other businesses you could be in?
That's very true, and I'm not dabbling in other business concepts right now at SeatGeek. I think with that particular business, it was just the realization that we were very naive when we started it, in the sense that we didn't understand how long it takes to generate a ton of users and how to go about getting users. And so, as time went on, I think the people who own the business now and who are working on it now have that mindset and have that perspective, they understand they're not in it for 6 months before they start seeing significant traction and any revenue, but it's about being in it for a 1 year, 2 year horizon, and then realizing that if you're creating something that tackles such a huge problem, that the opportunity is big. And so just to answer your question, We sort of realized that we were that's the type of business that we have to be very patient with, have to continually grow it. It's not one that it was automatically going to be a huge home run right out of the gate in terms of in both traffic and revenue. And as we started to realize that, we wanted to build something that from day one we could be earning revenue.
I see. So while you were building that one business, you kept saying, well, wouldn't it be great if we can make some money? Wouldn't it be great if we can earn a living while we were building out Scrivenia? Is that right?
It's one way of putting it. It's certainly we wanted a business that had a business model that was more entrenched in the web application, if that makes sense.
Okay. What I'm seeing a lot in my interviews is that before you really find the one, a lot of entrepreneurs seem to dabble, and so it's kind of like dating. You're dating one business, you're dating another, you're trying to see what fits, and then you find the one that fits, and that's the one that you marry. Is that a good description?
Mm-hmm. I think that's the right way to go about things in a lot of ways. And even at SeatGeek today, we are laser focused on building the number one ticketing consumer application out there. But at the same time, we see all these other inefficiencies in ticketing, and we're tackling them alongside. So, I think it is a question of making sure that you're getting feedback in other areas of and making sure that you can actually move and tackle other problems if they turn out to be bigger. So the dating analogy is pretty apt.
I've got a note here from earlier. You said that you were gathering data before you launched. What kind of data were you gathering?
So the way this forecasting model works is that we're gathering data from different, data points, for example, like team performance.
Sorry to interrupt that answer. I should have done this earlier on in the interview. I just kind of assume everyone knows what SeatGeek is. Can you just describe what it is, and then it'll help us get an understanding of how it evolved to what it is?
Sure, absolutely. So SeatGeek forecasts how sports and concert ticket prices move on the secondary ticket market. Secondary ticket market are sites like StubHub, RazorGator, anywhere where people are reselling tickets. And so what we're doing is we're providing a central consumer interface where consumers can come and they can search all these different markets and also learn, should I buy my tickets for this event now or should I wait 3 weeks to buy my tickets? And that second process that I talk about, that forecasting, is done through us gathering, tons of data, and then creating an algorithm around it that forecasts, with 85% accuracy where these ticket prices are going to go. So when I alluded to earlier about the data gathering process, that's obviously something that had to start. You can't ramp that up from day one. So we had started that data gathering process earlier to make sure that we were in a position that we could that once we committed to building and the application, we would have the data gathering process, the data in place that we can make the predictions.
I see. How could you know? In fact, here, let me just describe to people my experience with it. I wanted to
Sure.
get a ticket to the Yankees game.
Yep.
I went on your website. I not only saw all the different tickets that were available, but I saw them mapped out in the stadium. And then I could click on a specific seat, see who offered it. Maybe it was StubHub, maybe it was one of the other services, see what they were offering it for, and see how many tickets I had to buy. In order to get the price, I'd have to buy two tickets, or in some cases, four tickets. But what was especially interesting was on the bottom right of the webpage was a graph that showed that the ticket prices were going down, 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 down. And somewhere on the website, I forget where in the experience, you guys said, don't buy it yet, wait, it's probably gonna go down further. So that's what makes this thing so freaking incredible. You not only helped me find the tickets, you also helped me decide when to do it. Now, how did you put that in place? How can you predict it? How did you start predicting it in the beginning?
A huge component of the algorithm is obviously the data. So we're gathering all this data, and we're able to look at how ticket prices are moving over time for all these different events. My business partner Jack is very has a background in econometrics. Worked with some of the some other PhD students to build out this algorithm using the data, and so it's very academic in nature. It's econometrics, but we're looking at how ticket prices are moving, and looking at how that relates to other external factors like team performance, the venue size, weather, all those other things are being taken into this model that outputs really accurately how ticket prices move.
How'd you know it in the beginning? What were you doing? Did you go back in time and get all the weather forecasts out?
Yeah, so that's the whole data gathering process I'm talking about. It's just gathering everything that we thought would, could potentially affect ticket prices. You gather everything, and then you figure out which ones are statistically significant or not.
I see. So in the beginning part of 2009, did you go back and say, what was the temperature like in 2008? How did ticket prices adjust for 2008? How did you even get the historical data?
Yeah, so I mean, for things like team performance, that's always out there. You can go
Right?
to ESPN, you can figure that stuff
But
out.
ticket
The hardest,
pricing,
the
can you
ticket
get
price stuff,
that?
it's only available in real time. So
Right.
we're gathering. We also have been, we work with some academics who've shared some data with us and helped us on the model. And so that's something that we were the first people to contact them and have built relationships with them. And so that's and then also and but you're right. I mean, that data is only available in real time. And it's a competitive advantage that we have that enables us to, keeps us ahead of the other companies that, one day will try to copy what we do.
And how'd you do it when you launched?
Yeah,
How'd you do
so
it
we
before?
had.
How'd you do it in the beginning? How much data were you able to collect, considering the fact that a lot of this data isn't publicly available?
Yes. Oh, so we had, as I said, we were starting to gather data, from the beginning of Dream It, and we had a significant amount of data there, but we also were partnering with academics and had, data that's going back as much as 5 years. So we had a huge amount of data that we're making the predictions on, even when we started.
Can you help me understand how you decided to switch gears? Because it's tough when you're already moving in one direction to say, nah, this doesn't really work. In fact, using the dating analogy, when you're dating somebody, it's really tough to say, this isn't really the one, I gotta move on. And then to go out there and say it is even tougher. And here you did that within a matter of months. How did you come to that decision?
I really think it was around just, understanding and having a perspective on the time horizon it would take for a business like Scribner to be successful. I think it's going to be a massively successful business. I just think you have to be willing to spend time with it and understand that it's going to grow. You have to grow the traffic to a huge degree before you start seeing revenues. And if you look at our personal preference, it's to build something where from day one, revenue comes in the door. It feels more like a business, and it's not based on just hitting a home run, right? It's based on us growing the business slowly, steadily over time. Obviously trying to scale as quickly as possible, but there's revenue from the moment that you start. And I may or may not have covered this in an interview, but the way that we earn the revenue is every t much like Kayak, when someone buys a ticket through us, we earn a lead, an affiliate fee from the different secondary ticket markets. On average, tickets transact for upwards of $250 on our site, so we make $20 per transaction. So you can imagine, we're doing a lot of transactions now, how that can quickly scale up in terms of revenue. And that business model that was the heart of the concept is really exciting to us.
What size transactions are you doing now? Roughly how many a month?
We're as a private company, we don't really share too much about the number of transactions and
Are we in the
and
thousands,
traffic.
the tens of thousands?
Yeah,
We're in the thousands per month.
Yeah.
Okay.
Over that.
So in the tens of thousands per month
already.
Thousands, not tens of thousands. I was checking out your traffic. I think you guys are doing about 50,000 uniques a month. So it's got to be in the thousands, not the tens of thousands.
So the funny part about Compete is that Compete traffic isn't always terribly accurate. So I think Compete definitely shortchanges us in terms of the traffic. But it is what it is. I think it's fine. But it's a good tool to get a heuristic of how each company is doing. We're doing very well by the standards that we've set out when we started, and we're happy with the progress we've made. But looking to scale it up a lot going forward.
Where are you getting your audience, your customers?
So a couple of two main ways. The first is that we have so much of this data, right? We are the SeatGeeks, and as a result of that, we can put out really interesting content that gets picked up everywhere. So a good example is Steven Strasburg. I'm not sure you're familiar with the starting pitcher for the Washington Nationals, the most hyped up start from a prospect in a long time. So we'll look at how ticket prices move for an event like that, and we'll say, look, the fans really are excited about this event because ticket prices are trading at or selling at $105, and the average Nationals price is $51. So it's two times the average Nationals ticket price just to see this particular game. That gets picked up by places like the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. It'll get picked up by the New York Times. It'll get picked up everywhere, and they'll have often links to SeatGeek, and that's a way. There are so many stories in sports and music on a week-to-week basis that we don't need to be the focal point of these stories, but we just have to comment around them and using our data have an opportunity to expose people to our brand.
I see. And do you have a PR person who's doing this for you?
We work with a company called Launch Squad. They're a PR firm out in New York City and also San Francisco. I believe they have offices too. They've done a great job, and we put together a plan about how we're going to constantly push out interesting data to the media, and that's been a huge opportunity for us in terms of getting coverage.
Can you give me another example of a media hit that you guys had?
Oh, absolutely. Like another one is the Lakers. So the Lakers Celtics finals, we compared that to the we first of all looked at the ticket price for that event, and it's the tickets are selling at $600 a piece for the Lakers and $500 something for the Celtics for those finals games. But interestingly, when you compare it to the NHL, NHL ticket prices are actually higher than NBA ticket prices, and nobody saw that. I mean, who would have think NBA, it's the Lakers versus Celtics, the two most storied franchises in the NBA, yet the hockey ticket prices are higher. And when we put that out, it got a ton of interest. And these are two examples that were literally in the past week. So you can see that this is something that we don't have to worry about finding these events. There's huge events all the time. We just have to figure out how we can intelligently comment on them and push that data out.
Who comes up with those stories? And by the way, before you answer, can you push back a little bit from the camera? I want to make sure we get your full head in there. You don't have to go quite that far back. I just want to make sure that we don't cut off the top of your head.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So the question was...
Sorry, now lower the camera a little bit. There we go. All right.
I see.
That's good.
I can see myself at the bottom.
Yeah, I want to make sure you're fully in the picture.
So our PR firm comes up with all of us are sports fans and music fans. So we use that. We have a good sense about what the upcoming stories are just because we follow those sort of events. And if you follow sports in any capacity, you know that the Strasburg thing is huge or that the finals is huge. But we also the PR firm also keeps us up on our toes and make sure that we know what stories we should be commenting on, and what the good opportunities are.
I see. That's pretty cool. What about advertising? Are you doing online ads also?
We do a little bit of paid search, but just to experiment with it. I don't think at the moment see that as a big driver. Another good opportunity for us is around business development. If you go to Yahoo Sports, biggest mm-hmm. sports site on the internet, go to any Major League Baseball page, you'll see a ticketing link that goes to SeatGeek. And we get thousands of users every day who come through those ticketing links.
And that's paid placement, right?
No, so that's revenue share.
Okay.
So we work with these different – we built – for a good example, we also built widgets. And these widgets – show cool content that's from SeatGeek. It'll show you here are the upcoming three events in your area, three concerts in your area. And bloggers love this sort of stuff. They'll put it on their site. And as a result of that, we'll compensate them whenever someone makes a transaction through these widgets. We'll pay them 50% of the commission. But that's a great way for us to get our brand out there and for us to get risk for users because we're paying out on the transaction itself, not on the lead generating.
How do you tie back the sale to the company that you have an affiliate program with that then pays you.
Yeah, so that's all done automatically. So we just pass parameters and can track. You know, we're very, very care a lot about tracking. So we track everything. And one of the things is when someone clicks through any of these widgets, we're tracking that user, and then we're tracking them onto the secondary ticket market. And then we're able to associate all these transactions with where their original source was.
How'd you get the Yahoo deal? Actually, wait, I'm sorry. Let me stick with this, with the previous question about tying back revenue. How many companies are you working with that are paying you that you have to then keep track of the revenue that that you're getting from them?
Lots. And basically, any small blog becomes an affiliate of ours.
The other side. How many ticketing companies are you working with?
So we work with the major secondary ticket marks at the moment, and there's there's four big ones: StubHub, RazorGator, TicketsNow, and Ticket Network. Over time, we'll start working with a lot more companies. We're now integrating direct brokers into our feed, so that instead of going to like RazorGator, you can now go to the broker who listed their stuff on RazorGator. So over, within the next month or so, we'll have another 50 companies whose tickets will be showing on SeatGeek. But right now, it's the four major secondary ticket markets.
Okay. All right. And that explains why it's also easier to track. If you had more, I think it would be a little bit tougher, no?
Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of the stuff is pretty templated. They have no idea what these, what we're passing to them. We're passing this extra parameter. They just know that, in their tracking module, they need to show it. And then once we have that, we can associate where the transaction came from.
Okay. The Yahoo deal, how'd you get that?
It's actually quite fortuitous and serendipitous. And one of the, if you had any pieces of advice that I would give, we were at TechCrunch 50, and one of the companies that was next to us, I'm actually blanking on the name, had a contact at Yahoo Sports who happened to run business development there. And it was sort of the right place at the right time, where they were looking for ticketing. They were looking for new ticketing opportunities in potentially the secondary space. And we started the relationship in October. And then at the start of Major League Baseball season, we became their ticketing solution for baseball. And it showed a lot. I think it's a good lesson in how important it is to get yourself out there, because you never know who you're talking to and the networks that they have. So I think it's always helpful just to ask people, do you know anybody who could, works at a content site who would be helpful? And sometimes you're going to get these home runs that happen just out of nowhere. And we've had a great relationship with them so far, and I think it shows a lot about them too, that they'd be, they've been willing to work with a company like us. We've never had any technical hiccups or anything like that, but we're a startup. We launched in September, and they've been very excited about it. They like the product that we have, and they like the fact that we're so laser focused on making a great user experience.
Cool. All right. So what did you get out of DreamIt? You told us about the speakers who came in, and you told us about the resources that they had, but how did you personally benefit?
So certainly the biggest thing, I think, is having 3 months where the only thing you think about and the only thing you do is you build your company, and the only people you see are people who are in the same boat too. I think there's like the motivation that you get from that experience is second to none. We work every waking moment, but it felt great because the companies next to you were working just as hard. We're all killing themselves for the same goal. They all wanted to build a company that was viable by the end of the summer. So I think that's the first and foremost. If you have to pick one reason to do an incubator, is that you'll never be short of motivation. And then also, I think that the network is huge, right? If I'm an early stage VC, I know that there's 100 companies say that graduate from these incubators every single year. I don't think I'd look at that many companies that didn't do that, right? It's a great signal that you someone else has screened you, has said that you guys are intelligent potentially, and that you guys have a cool concept. And then at that point you have to show traction, all that good stuff. But at the same time, I think it's great when you are able to talk to VCs, talk to investors afterwards. They say, look, we went to the DreamIt program. Here are the people involved with it, and you rattle off some very impressive names who have given their time for the program. I think it makes a huge difference. It's much different, as you talked about. You can't just call why we didn't raise money at first from angel investors when we started Scribnia, because you just can't call angel investors and say, would you invest in me? They find out about you because you build a network.
I see. What about the product evolution? Did they help with that at all?
Yeah.
How?
I think it's just having people who have been there, done that, and you can get feedback from them.
Do you have a specific
them.
Example of how they gave you feedback that impacted your business, that impacted the product specifically?
I'm trying to think. That's a good question. One of the things that I'm trying to think of a good example.
Mm-hmm. What about the speakers? Did they come in and give you advice? Did they take a look at your business and give you direction?
Absolutely. Speakers were fantastic.
Okay.
For a good one, so we had people like Chris Fralick come in and talk to us about business development. I had no idea what business development was before I came into that summer, and he explained to us, you know, here's what business development looks like. Here's, you know, here's the mindset you have to have. Here's how you go out and you build your network, and you go out and you sign potential affiliates, and that's all I do now. You know, that's my full-time job at SeatGeek. So it's amazing that that transition that I made from having no idea what it was, and this nebulous thing before I joined the summer, to like understanding the ins and outs of it. And you're not going to get that in a 40-minute conversation, but he really laid out the basics of something that you're not going to find out in any textbook. And I think that's a big thing, right? The advice you're getting from these guys, you can't find anywhere else because there's no textbook written on this sort of material.
What advice do you have for people who need to do business development now that you do it all the time and you've learned so much?
I wouldn't say I'm wise by any sort of the imagination. I would say that
more experienced.
More experience that, as I said, I think it's so important to constantly build your network, and don't look at, you know, you can't look at people you talk to like, okay, what can I get out of this person? Or like, how am I going to get to the next person? It's actually building, and it sounds so cliched, but to build true, genuine relationships with people means that you can be open to them. If they ask you, you know, can you introduce me to this person? Always be immediately jump to introduce them to other people, because that pays itself back in the long term. I think any success that we've had in business development thus far is that we're very open. Like if someone wants to come meet with us, we're always open to talk with them and sit down with them for a half an hour, talk to them about SeatGeek. And out of that, we've had great conversations. You know, I unfortunately can't give the names until we start closing and integrating, but we're in some very strong, big conversations right now, just because of that sort of open mentality.
How much did you sell Scribnia for?
So we sold it for an undisclosed amount. It was a minor exit. It's not,
Under 50?
It was under $100,000.
Under $100,000. And how'd you find, let me see who you sold it to. You sold it to the guy who owns HispanoClick, Mark Duquette? How'd you find him?
We're pretty open about, we weren't open about selling, but he had stumbled across a site, found it interesting. He really liked the concept. So Mark's background is that he founded HispanoClick, and he understands the content publishing, and he understands the how to advertise very well. And so he was looking for an opportunity where he could apply that sort of skills to a site like Scribnia, which had a good opportunity to get a huge audience, but didn't really think critically about how to advertise and how to gain advertising revenue. So he approached us and was had used the site and thought it was interesting. And asked us pretty candidly whether we were looking to sell or not.
Did he just stumble on the site? How did he even find the site?
he ended up using the site, and then he reached out to us, and we discussed selling. So it's very fortuitous. It's different experience than most.
What about Mark Walken, one of your investors, super bright guy? How did you connect with him?
Yeah, Mark is a great guy. So how do you know Mark?
Actually, believe it or not, I did business with him years ago, back when he was at Sony.
No, so Mark is a great example again of another fortuitous connection. We were we're in an incubation space in New York, and one of the companies there is a company that part of the Angel Vine Network, which is sort of an angel mentorship program in New York. And Mark was working with that company, and he had actually been using SeatGeek at the time. He had actually had it on his browser, and he said, "Oh, this is a cool site." And then this guy Josh Weinstein, who runs GoodCrush, the company I was referring to, said, "Oh yeah, those guys sit right there." And so that's how we actually met for the first time. He was checking out the site, he liked it, and that's how we met each other. And we actually have a lot in common. He's a Dartmouth guy too. And he's super, super helpful. Mark is literally a world expert in A/B testing, so he understands the ins and outs of how do you test for certain things and how do you improve your conversion rate. And we Every time you use SeatGeek, you're in some sort of test. We test rigorously, and that's the sort of feedback that he's been very hands-on about giving. So he works with us and helps us design these tests and helps us implement these tests.
He's one of the pioneers. He started one of the early A-B multivariant testing companies. So what has he taught you? What specifically have you learned about A-B testing or about testing in general from him?
I think it's just a question of figuring out what's important to test. It's a process, right? So testing, there's no – It's about understanding here are the things that in the past, from his huge background, huge wealth of knowledge, here are some of the things that that are likely to improve conversion rate. But he doesn't tell us, hands down, just do this, implement these changes. He would never describe himself as like a UX expert. It's more about understanding that these are the things that you might want to test and to see what happens. And so a great example is actually when we launched – so when we launched this partnership with Yahoo – all the users from Yahoo came to a certain page. We'll call it our team page, where it shows all the upcoming events for a certain team. And we actually have reduced our bounce rate by, I think, 40%. 40%, because we've followed his testing advice. We've I can actually send you screenshots of what the two look like. It's unbelievable how different they are. We did things like we tested whether do we want to show the forecast to these users? Do we not want to show the forecast to these users? How big do we want the buttons to be that say buy tickets? What color should they be? And so he gave us all these things that we should think about testing. And it made it a lot faster. I think we'd arrived at a good solution in the long term, but to be able to do it so quickly within a matter of weeks, it was because he gave us sort of these are the things that you should think about testing.
Okay, and you're saying bounce rates improved because you changed the layout of the email?
No, not the email. So when Yahoo users come via ticketing link on Yahoo,
they bounce rates on the site, right? Okay,
on the site, right, exactly. So people would come and they just. We didn't give a very good description of what SeatGeek is. They wouldn't know that it's a ticketing company. They would have these forecasts that, I think they're important. Obviously, that's why we built the company, but it wasn't contextualized for them, so they didn't understand what the forecast meant. And so, not including those forecasts, which to us was just a crazy when we first thought about it, but not including the forecast and putting very strong buy ticket buttons. And doing things like that and just completely redesigning the page in a lot of ways improved our bounce rate 40%.
That explains why, and I was wondering this, why the chart is on the bottom of the page that I described earlier. If what you guys are is a ticket forecasting company, why don't I see it at the top or at the center of the page? And that's why, because it's too confusing for people?
Well, it's that part of that, but more importantly, it's because we want the map to be front and center. That's where people interact with and buy the tickets. And we found that when you put the analytics section with the graphs and the forecast up in the header, the downside is that people don't always get a chance to interact with the map. And on some computers, the map wouldn't even be visible. So we thought, let's make the map hyper-visible. That's the one thing we want users interacting with. And then as they sort of scroll through the listings and start moving down to the bottom of the page, then they see this really cool analytics section, and they can learn more information.
Okay. All right, I got someone in the audience from Fusion Apps. Do you know that company?
I don't know.
Great company in New Jersey, and sounds like you're in New York right now.
I am in New York, yep.
Okay. He says, you guys received $25,000 in the incubation phase. How was the money spent?
On people. So we brought on another developer, and we brought on a social media guy over the summer. Both were great hires, worked out really well for us. But that's primarily what we use the money for.
Okay. Let's talk about actually one other question also from Fusion Apps before I move to mine. When you guys sold, what was the split between you and your partner, Jack?
So we're 50-50 equity partners.
All right. So you guys have some savings even while you're building up a startup. It gives you a little bit of cushion, no?
Yep. That was very helpful. Yep.
All right. Before this interview, you told me about a startup that you launched that I didn't find anything – that I didn't see anything about online. And I do a lot of research on my guests. Evolving Box. What's Evolving Box?
It's funny enough. I think we probably have more publicity for Evolving Box than we do for Scrivener in a lot of ways. So Evolving Box was when we were at Dartmouth College, it's very difficult for us to get furniture. It's a school in the middle of nowhere, and you end up buying furniture and then throw it out at the end of every year. We thought this is a perfect example where a rental market works and one which – everything is online. So it'd be great if you could go to this online interface, let's call it Evolving Box, and you can click, I want these six items, and that's all you have to do. You click buy, and then magically these items, someone knocks on your door and these items appear in your room, and then at the end of the year they're taken out, or at the end of the term they're taken out, depending on how long you're at college. And so we built the site. So we built the site, and then we ended up hiring students to help us with the delivery process of moving all this these furniture items to the different rooms. And it was the largest business in Dartmouth, still is the largest business today. It's been passed on probably three times now. So it's the largest business of Dartmouth today. We actually franchised that to a couple schools because the model makes sense at almost every college, right? Like, why would you ever buy furniture when you're not going to need it? And colleges love that sort of stuff because they want to reduce waste at all costs. And that furniture ends up sitting outside in the hallway at the end of the year. So that was Evolving Vox, and it was a great experience. We learned a ton from it, and it was our first dabble into entrepreneurship.
Who's running it now?
When we sold it, we sold it to a bunch of students who are younger than us. We sold it for $25,000, not very much, but those students then sold it on and passed it on. And I'm not sure now what it sold for, but when we sold it at the time, the funny part was that we looked at how much it should have been worth by any sort of business measurements and how much we could sell for. And there's definitely a divide there because it's something that students need to run given their access to the dorms and all that sort of stuff. So it's now run by, I think, a group of 8 students, maybe almost even higher than that now, because you need more and more students to be able to afford the upfront payment to buy the business.
Did you sell the furniture or did you rent it?
So we rented the furniture only. We buy it wholesale, okay, and then we rent it out to the students.
I see. You had to put up how much money up front to start the business?
It was a great business because we would the first time in the fall when we launched our senior year, we took in all the orders. When those orders came in, we capped it, and then we went out and bought all that furniture. So our risk was relatively small. It was just that difference between the renting period and the wholesale costs, and that actually wasn't that's not that big a difference.
Oh, really? So you basically selling it, renting it for what portion of the cost?
We were a good amount. I mean, because a lot of stuff we were getting wholesale, so you're getting you're getting quality furniture at a good rate. So it depended on each item. I mean, for a TV, we're using sites like companies like Best Buy, and there you're going to get regular retail prices. But for futons, we're getting these fantastic deals, and because you're buying them in bulk and you're buying from a futon manufacturer directly.
So rent was maybe 80% of your cost.
Yeah, about that. Yeah, a year was, and then you figure it was about 80% of the cost, and then you're also reusing it. I think we modeled out 3 years as those furniture items are reusable, and then should they get damaged, you just charge the student who rented it last. So that's a business that I would love to see just scale and be everywhere. Unfortunately, it's something that's particularly easy to run when you're a college student, can access any single dorm, and don't have to worry about paying health insurance to your employees, but it's a business that makes a lot of sense, and I wish it existed more.
And the students delivered it in their own cars?
We'd rent U-Hauls.
I see, okay. All right, it sounds like even that wasn't the first business that you started. What else did you start?
No, that was it.
You didn't have any businesses as a kid? You sound really entrepreneurial, is why I ask.
No, I didn't, actually. No lemonade stand for me.
Okay.
The first business I did was Evolving Vox.
All right, let's end it with what's next. What's next for SeatGeek? I want to make sure to just say this really clearly, and it's going to be so interesting to see what the transcribers come back with as the spelling and understanding of what the company name is, because we say it pretty quickly. I'll say it this for whoever's transcribing, SeatGeek. But leave the other misspellings in there. They'll be good for search engine optimization. Plus, it'll be also interesting to see how people spell your name. So anyway, what's next for SeatGeek?
So SeatGeek, we're looking to become the consumer-facing application where people buy tickets online. And that's a really grand statement and something that we know we have a lot of room to build and a lot of stuff to build in order to get there. But over the next couple months, we'll start expanding our event coverage. Right now, we focus on every major league sport, so it's football, basketball, baseball, and hockey, and also concerts, pretty much every concert in the secondary ticket market. So as we expand, we want to start – rolling out a prediction algorithm for things like theater, things like stand-up comedy, some of these other UFC fights, and just having people be able to use it for more than just buying concert and sports tickets. So that's a big initiative for us at the moment.
All right. Well, thanks for doing the interview. It's great meeting you.
And thanks a lot, Andrew.
I'm going to keep watching SeatGeek and see how it evolves.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
And thank you all for watching. Bye.